Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello and welcome. My name is Joe Moore, filling in for Juanita Stevenson today. On our program this morning, we look at a plan to bring mass transit to Fresno with a new system called BRT. Will it be enough for you to give up your car and ride to work? We'll also find out about how the annual Valley tradition known as Greek Fest is coming together this year and learn what's in store for this year's festival. That's coming up later in our program. But first, a new study on criminal justice practices throughout Central California is out. And the study spells interesting news for residents of Central California when it comes to the Valley's prison population. A new report from the Center for Juvenile and Criminal Justice shows that Valley counties, on average, send more people to jail and state prison than the rest of the state. Kings County topped the list with the state's highest per capita population in state prison, over 1,500 adults for every 100,000 county residents. Tulare and Kern counties weren't far behind. Kings County also had the highest overall incarceration rate in the state, which combines both county jail and state prison populations. For every 1,000 adult felony arrests last year, Kings County had over 1,300 inmates in prison or county jail.
Kings County does appear sort of at the top of every metric for state incarceration and certainly high on the jail incarceration rates, although not at the top.
Selena Teji from the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice says that the reliance on incarcerating criminals instead of alternative programs could be a problem now that the state's realignment is reducing the state prison population and shifting inmates to county jails.
Over the last 8 months of realignment, they've actually received a lot more responsibility for those low-level offenders that are being realigned under AB 109. They've seen a big 54% of new criminal justice population that they now have to supervise locally.
She says Valley counties may want to look to the model of others throughout the state.
For example, Santa Cruz, again, investing in pretrial alternatives, investing in alternatives to incarceration. San Francisco is another example who has a long history of providing community-based organizations providing services to the criminal justice population. It's been incredibly successful.
There was some good news. Kings County had one of the lowest reported crime rates in the state, unlike Fresno and Kern counties, which were number 3 and 4 out of California's 58 counties. This is Valley Public Radio News. And joining us now on the phone is Michael Mayles, senior researcher for the Center on Criminal and Juvenile Justice in California. Michael, welcome to our program today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
This new study that is just out paints some really interesting numbers on the practices in California. California has 58 counties, but there's not one uniform standard for how inmates are sentenced or where they're serving their time or other alternative programs to incarceration. That's something that's really interesting because we see a lot of difference between the various counties throughout the state. Is that not correct?
There's incredible differences. We might get into the realignment policies in a minute, but prior to realignment, which was basically designed to transfer prisoners now held in state prisons to local jurisdictions for non-serious offenders, Kings County, I heard you mention earlier, sentenced about 10 times more of its felons to state prison than did San Francisco County. And, you know, you see these disparities around the state between counties, and they're just incredibly diverse.
Exactly, and the issue with Kings County is interesting because in Kings County, it seems that more of the population is than the state average is serving time in state prison and not so much in the county jails, and that, as you mentioned, points some very interesting future trend analysis for the realignment process that the state's right now in and totally changing the way criminal justice works in California.
Well, Kings County is kind of off the in a lot of respects. Kings County actually also has a higher rate of jailing than the state average and a much, much higher rate of incarceration in state prisons than the state average. And it also has several state prisons within the county. And this really shouldn't be affecting the numbers we're talking about here because we're counting prisoners who are sentenced by a county, not those housed in a county. So Kings County is definitely one that we're looking at to see why its rate of incarceration is so much higher than that of other counties. And it must be very expensive and also make it difficult to implement realignment.
It's interesting. Your study started a few years ago, I believe, in looking at the numbers throughout the state. There's not really a uniform way for counties to report data on all of these different metrics that you analyze, from the population in county jails to state prison and other sentencing practices. Is that correct?
Well, the reporting is pretty uniform. I mean, the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation has its unified system for reporting prisoners, what offense, what county, and the demographics, and so forth. And what used to be called the Correction Standards Authority, I think is now called the Board of Community Corrections, reports on jails, and they have a uniform system, too. So the reporting is fairly uniform. What is divergent is the number of people per capita or per felony that get sent to jail or prison, depending on which county you're in.
So give us highlights of the data that came out in the report last week for our radio audience.
Well, we basically covered the main thing, that counties have extremely divergent rates. I mean, where you get arrested for a felony and sentenced for a felony is one of the most important determinants of whether you go to jail or prison, not the felony you commit. So the same felony in San Francisco may get a local alternative kind of sentence, such as probation or community supervision or so forth, whereas in another county it may get you packed off to state prison. So unfortunately, a number of counties, and I guess this may be the key finding since we're all about the money, a number of counties were using the state prison system to send huge numbers of their rather low-level drug and property offenders. And by that, I don't mean people who were perfectly good citizens. These were a lot of nuisance offenders who had repeated convictions for relatively low-level crimes. And they were being packed off to state prison where they were occupying extremely expensive bed space and getting the state into all kinds of trouble with overcrowding and medical issues and court mandates to reduce the state prison population, as well as fiscal burden. So the state implemented realignment policies under Assembly Bill 109 to try to get many of these offenders, lower-level offenders, returned back to counties and the local jurisdictions to manage. Naturally, the counties that committed the largest numbers of people to state prison, especially low-level offenders, are the ones having the most difficulties in managing these offenders at the local level.
Another interesting thing on the numbers with Kings County, while it ranks at the top of the incarceration rate and the overall state prison population, if you look at the crime rate, Kings County is near the bottom, at least in the bottom third. And that's different than Fresno and Tulare County, who are more at the top of the incarceration numbers. Is there an argument to be made that this aggressive policy is a deterrent to crime, or is that, in your opinion, maybe not entirely accurate?
Well, as a good standard liberal, I'd want to say, oh, that's preposterous. Imprisonment doesn't reduce crime. We have numerous studies to show that. But I think you really have to look at this on a case-by-case basis. It's true. Kings County is one of the poorest counties in the state in terms of income and poverty levels. It's surrounded by a number of counties with relatively high incarceration and poverty rates and felony rates, such as Tulare, for example, Fresno County, and so forth. Nearby counties, Kern County especially, very high rates of crime and imprisonment, and yet Kings does not have a very high rate. That may be, again, I'm totally speculation here, but Kings is also the site of a number of large state prisons, and there may be a deterrent effect to having prisons in your community. It's something I'd really like to study, because Kings is one of the most unique counties in the state in terms of, as you mentioned, its felony rate, its crime rate, as well as its very high incarceration rate. And it might be kind of a model to study to see whether incarceration has an effect on crime that we haven't yet perceived in one way or another.
Have you seen any trend in the numbers since you began this study a few years ago?
Well, the counties are becoming more disparate. They're becoming more divergent. The state prison population has been fairly stable for the last 5 to 10 years. It went up rapidly, of course, since 1980 to about 2000, early 2000s, and then since then it's been stable, and now it's declining rapidly under realignment. So there's that trend overall. Second, there has been counties becoming more and more the numbers have spread out. That is, counties that sent very few people to state prison, such as San Francisco and Contra Costa and Alameda, have been sending even fewer, while other counties that had very high rates have been sending more, such as the aforementioned Kings and Kern. So what we now see is almost two different worlds, very high incarceration counties and very low incarceration counties, and all under this mandate to realign, to handle more offenders at the local level. And I guess I should hint at one of the findings that a new report we're issuing is going to show, that actually there was a slight increase in new prison commitments in the second quarter of 2012, and the counties diverged even more. That is, about 20 counties showed continued declines in prison commitments, while about 33 counties showed sharp increases in new prison commitments. And so we're trying to look at how this could have happened and what kinds of drug and property offenses, particularly drug offenses, are now being sent to state prison by a relatively small number of counties, more or less in defiance of the realignment goal. So I guess that would be the big thing, is that counties send vastly disparate numbers of people to prison, and that generates disparate pressures on the state and great differences in costs.
We're talking about new numbers released from the California Sentencing Institute today on Valley Edition. It's a project of the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice, and our guest is Michael Males. He's a senior researcher with the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice. In our report that opened up this segment, Selena Tedji was talking about some of the alternative programs that some counties use. I think she mentioned Santa Cruz and San Francisco. Can you tell us about those and what some counties are doing that maybe we don't see very much in the Central Valley?
Well, I don't know so much about the Central Valley, and I'm not really an expert on alternative programs, but one of the things that many counties use in lieu of sending people to jail, and by the way, jail or prison costs something around $30,000 to $50,000 per inmate per year. So the question is, what could you do with that money that might have a better effect on crime and public safety and rehabilitating the individual? And counties such as Santa Cruz, San Mateo, San Francisco, and a number of others have implemented the use of probation and alternative release programs under community supervision that try to handle offenders within the community. And keep them in contact with some of the more beneficial programs and individuals that can help them, redirect them away. And this seems to be particularly effective, and even more than effective, it seems to be almost imperative for drug offenders, because drug-involved offenders do not improve in prison. That's one of the things we're pretty clear on, especially older drug offenders who are comprising the rising bulk of new commitments and to state prison. These 30, 40, 50 age drug-involved offenders who have had a habit for many years and developed crime patterns around those habits have not been at all helped by being sent to prison. In fact, they usually come back worse than they went in. And we're trying to see if even a combination of jail and local probation, such as in Santa Cruz County, is a better way of handling the drug-offending population, which previously a large percentage had been sent to state prison. So I think the alternative programs are generally going to revolve around handling long-term addicts. I don't want to be Pollyanna. Those have had some success, not spectacular, but it certainly seems a better direction to go than simply locking them up and having them come back to the community a few years later worse than they went in.
As we talk about the issue with the incarceration rate and realignment, I'd like to now bring in another guest. We have joining us on the telephone from San Francisco, Jeff Adachi. He is a San Francisco public defender, and he has some interesting things to bring to the conversation as far as the public defender angle of this. From your seat in the criminal justice population, not population, but in the criminal justice world, how do you interpret these numbers, Jeff?
Well, I think it's interesting, Joe, that if you look at the counties which, in our view, over-incarcerate, and Kings County is a perfect example, they incarcerate six times the rate that we do here in San Francisco, is that you find that in those counties there are no public defender offices. And the reality is that a big variable factor in terms of what happens to people in criminal cases and juvenile cases is the quality of representation they receive. If you're represented by a lawyer who zealously represents you and also is looking for alternative placement programs, then you're going to get a better outcome than a person who is represented by a lawyer who doesn't try to obtain those kinds of outcomes for the clients. And, you know, when you look at the quality of representation across the country, I sat for many years on American Bar Association committee where we looked at the quality of representation that indigents receive. We found, again, I mean, vast divergent sort of outcomes depending on, again, the quality of representation and particularly the caseloads. We looked at some states where public defenders were handling as many as 500 cases at a time, a ridiculous number of felony cases. It's what we call the walking Sixth Amendment violation, referring to the constitutional amendment, because these are lawyers who, you know, quite frankly, you could be, you know, the greatest lawyer in the world, and you couldn't do a good job on these cases. So I think that's very interesting. The other thing that you find is that, as you know, Michael mentioned earlier, if you have alternative programs which are available and you utilize those, what we found here in San Francisco is that the outcomes are much better. We've cut recidivism rates since realignment down by as much as 50%, and we've done this by not jailing people and instead finding placements which include drug counseling, education, employment, opportunities, as well as, you know, helping people find a stable residence.
Michael, I can imagine some people would say, what exactly is the difference from whether the public defender is a county employee or that's a private attorney that's contracted by the county? What is the difference in your opinion? They're getting representation, they're having a defense, as our laws provide. Why? What's the big deal?
You know, I'm not all familiar with public defense and the difference between public and private representation. I do know that in a number of areas, as was mentioned, the quality of public defense varies rapidly in some areas, or varies greatly, and in some areas is drastically underfunded. And when you get poor representation, it's absolutely true. The public defender is part of the supervisory aspect of the criminal justice system, and in fact, a very key part of the supervisory aspect. And what a lot of these offenders, particularly drug-involved ones, need is supervision, a continuing, ongoing supervision, as well as representation of their interests. And there are many counties and many jurisdictions where they simply don't get that. And as mentioned, those tend to be the ones that have poorer outcomes, long-term outcomes in terms of recidivism. So I'm sorry, I can't answer your question better, but that seems to be the general pattern.
We're talking about the incarceration rate, new numbers that were released last week from the Center for Juvenile and Criminal Justice, and this paints some interesting numbers for Central California, and that Valley counties on this list typically have some of the highest per capita incarceration rates in the state among the 58 counties. When you look at a state like California that's so big and so diverse, and there's so many different approaches, we're taught in civics class, we're supposed to have equal protection under the law. Is it really equal that we have 58 different standards for treatment for what could be the same crime? I'll toss to Michael first on this one. Get your thoughts.
Well, no. I mean, courts have generally allowed pretty wide what's called prosecutor discretion and sentencing discretion on the grounds that it's simply impossible to guarantee an absolute standard of justice based on the divergence of the kinds of cases and criminals that the system handles. So they've allowed pretty wide latitude. But when you're looking at 10 times the rate of imprisonment per felon, and it's now risen to 18 times the rate of imprisonment for a felon in Kings County compared to San Francisco County, I think you are looking at violations of equal protection, yes.
And I should say we did invite the Kings County District Attorney's Office to participate in our program, and they declined the opportunity today. As we're looking at these numbers here, one of the things that also jumps out is the state's three strikes law and the number of individuals sentenced under that law. again, Kings County and other Valley counties are at the top. Turning to Jeff, how do you see, are counties applying three strikes in a different way, or is it just a factor of the, you know, the unique crimes and individuals in each locale?
Absolutely. You know, each county has its own elected district attorney, each city and county, and so the district attorney determines the three strikes policy. But the reality is that because the district attorney has discretion when to charge three strikes, and currently now counties can, or district attorneys can, charge the three strikes law. In other words, they can put someone away for life, even if the crime that the person is convicted of is a nonviolent, non-serious felony. Now, there's a ballot initiative that will be on the ballot in November that will change this and will make it so the third strike has to be a serious and or violent felony, but currently that's not the state of the law. And so, for example, in San Francisco, the district attorney here, George Gascon, who's the former police chief, has determined not to charge three strikes when the third strike is not a serious or violent felony. Now, you go across to San Mateo, which is about a 30-minute drive, and commit a crime there, a non-serious, non-violent felony. If you have two strikes, you're going to be charged with three strikes. So you have these disparate outcomes, you know, based on geography. That's really what it comes down to. But, you know, I wanted to jump in because you asked an excellent question earlier about the difference between public defenders and private contractors, and there is a difference. You know, public defenders were established in California here in 1916, and because it's the most economic, efficient way to provide high-quality representation to thousands of people. For example, in San Francisco here, we provide legal representation for 20,000 people a year. I know in Fresno, the Board of Supervisors is going to be voting, I think today or this week, on an initiative to essentially allow private attorneys to be appointed and not require the county to have a public defender's office handle these cases. I think that would be a huge, huge mistake. Again, public defender offices are able to focus on the practice of law. They don't have to worry about handling other cases. They are committed and dedicated to handling the cases assigned by the court. And also, you have attorneys who are more experienced and can take advantage of programs. And here in San Francisco, we have reentry programs. We have social workers on staff, and we're able to really to give the cases the attention that they need. And so, again, looking at these incarceration numbers, it doesn't surprise me that in the counties where you don't have a public defender, you have outcomes which disproportionately send people to prison. And again, that costs a lot of money if you're a taxpayer.
We're talking about criminal justice on Valley Edition today, and you mentioned the situation in Fresno County. The Board of Supervisors this week will be voting on whether or not to put a measure on the November ballot to allow Fresno County voters to change a section of the county's charter, which is essentially make it easier for the county to outsource the 54 employees. Excuse me, the 84 employees in the public defender's office here. It's something that's been talked about for some time as counties are trying to save money. And as budget cuts certainly are not new and unique just to Fresno, all counties throughout the state are facing these issues. Jeff, how are public defender's offices throughout the state faring right now?
Well, again, it really depends. If you look at, say, Los Angeles, for example, they're a very well-funded public defender office. And then you look at other smaller counties, particularly rural counties, and you find offices that are severely underfunded. So it really comes down to funding, first of all. But what we're also seeing, this is what's happening in Fresno, is that the counties are trying to save money, and so they're trying to outsource to whoever would be the lowest bidder. And the danger in that is that you're going to be hiring people to represent people who aren't going to be doing what needs to be done on the case. When you're charged with a crime, you could be facing the death penalty. You could be facing life imprisonment. Do you want an attorney who's going to be cutting corners, who doesn't have the resources to properly investigate your case? We've seen what happens, for example, in Illinois, where you had dozens and dozens of people who were wrongfully convicted of death penalty crimes. And so, you know, if we're talking about ensuring that our justice system works for everyone, including the poor, it's critical that you have a well-funded public defender's office. Now, Kenneth Taniguchi, he's a public defender of Fresno, is someone who's got an excellent reputation and somebody who has really consistently fought for more resources. In a sense, he's being penalized because now the Board of Supervisors is saying, well, let's change the charter, which is the constitution of Fresno, and let's make it so we can hire somebody else other than the public defender to handle these cases. Now, could you imagine them doing that to the district attorney, outsourcing the district attorney and saying, okay, we're going to assign it to the lowest bidder? They would never dream of doing that in a million years, but they are doing that to the Fresno Public Defender's Office because Kenneth Taniguchi has been fighting for more resources for that office, and this, in a sense, would undermine his efforts.
We're talking with Jeff Adachi, the San Francisco Public Defender, and Michael Mayles from the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice today. And we've been talking about the incarceration rate and sentencing practices and public defender issues, but it all has to all be in this orbit of realignment and this process that the state is in right now in trying to undertake this major shift in the way criminal justice is handled through state prisons and county jails and alternative programs. The realignment process, where we are today in August 2012, we're around a year into it right now. Where, Michael, do you see that we stand right now? How has the process gone so far? Has it been smooth? Have there been unexpected obstacles in the way?
Well, I would say to this point, realignment has been spectacularly successful. It has dramatically reduced the number of low-level drug and property offenders and other offenders that are nonviolent in state prison. You know, in some cases, for instance, petty theft with prior, where your sentencing offense was a petty theft and you got sent to state prison because you had a prior conviction for something, those people really don't belong in state prison, and that population has fallen by about 70% in the state prison system. Similarly, drug possession offenses have offenders have dropped by about 70%, and that's exactly what realignment was trying to accomplish. We've seen a reduction of about 30,000 in the overall prison population, and the goal by 2017 was 40,000. So in the first 9 months of realignment, the Assembly Bill 109 has accomplished about three-fourths of the goal that was expected by 2017 and is far ahead of projections. So that's the good news, that realignment is working, and it's retaining the violent population and the serious offending population in state prison while returning the low-level offenders to the counties where they can probably better be served. The only blip on the radar showed up in the most recent report, which I mentioned earlier, in which there's a slight increase in the number of new commitments to state prison in the second quarter of 2012 compared to the first quarter. It's still well below the numbers being sent to state prison, still about 40% below numbers being sent to state prison prior to realignment. But there was a slight increase, and we're going to try to get more detailed information and find what offenses, what counties, and so forth, because, 20 counties continued declines and about 30 counties had increases. So there continue to be disparities, and there continues to be this idea that, well, perhaps we have achieved the easiest reduction in the state prison population, and from here on out, it's going to be much tougher to reduce the population at the same rate that it's been reduced in the first 9 months of realignment.
Do you think that there may be a future for or future problems with just the funding that will, as I understand it, decline in future years for counties to deal with this new influx of former prison population?
Well, there's always problems with funding. I mean, it's just for anything, any aspect of government that you're talking about, especially when you're dealing with state and local. Shifting back and forth of responsibilities and resources. So, yes, I think the funding problems are going to continue. There was some argument that counties that were sending too many people to state prison in the first place are getting the benefits of, more money for reducing their excessive prison populations than the counties that were more frugal and less state-dependent in the first place. There's that argument. There's the decline in funding that's going to occur in years out, and that's the presumption, and I think the pressure that counties have to find, local jurisdictions have to find ways of managing populations, especially drug-involved populations that don't involve expensive incarceration alternatives. They have to start finding other options for dealing with this population that are more effective and less costly, both to the public and to the individual. So I think part of this decrease in funding over time is to kind of put the screws on the counties and local jurisdictions to come up with better alternatives than we've seen in the past, and certainly ones at the state level, they were not able to implement through the prison system.
Our guest has been Michael Males, senior researcher for the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice. Michael, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Jeff Adachi, the San Francisco public defender, thank you for joining our discussion on criminal justice and public defender issues throughout California. Jeff, really appreciate your time.
Thanks, Joe.
You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. In just a moment, stay with us as we'll talk about the city of Fresno's ambitious new plan to get you out of your car and on mass transit. It could be coming to Fresno's Blackstone Avenue and Ventura sooner than you think. That's coming up in just a moment on Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Kaiser Permanente Fresno and Cahuilla Delta Medical Center.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition.
You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. My name is Joe Moore, filling in for Juanita Stevenson today. It's three letters, BRT, and it could be coming to Fresno very soon. In fact, it is coming to Fresno very soon. It's called Bus Rapid Transit. People have called it light rail on wheels. And in Central California, where the only real mass transit operation is in Sacramento, this new development could be a real big news for the city of Fresno. John Downs from the city of Fresno's Transportation Division joins us now to tell us more about this project. John, you had a big meeting on Saturday at City Hall. Tell us about what the community is saying about BRT.
People seem to be very excited about the opportunity to bring a very progressive type of public transportation to the Fresno area. And we were actually meeting to talk with folks to get their ideas about their perceptions about how we might name this product, what the product might look like. But more than that, I think, to talk about what the product offers for the community, which is a more reliable, a more upscale type of service. I mean, it's going to be a very attractive, faster, unique kind of service for Fresno.
So let's take a step back now and look at exactly what we're talking about here. This is around a $50 million project to build a service that is of a quality that's like a light rail system, but is on a motorized bus rather than a dedicated train running on rails, correct?
It has been described as light rail on rubber wheels, although, that can be confusing. I say light rail systems typically have exclusive right-of-way. We're not doing that in Fresno, but what we are doing is providing transit signal priority for these buses, queue jump lanes to get them out ahead of the traffic, very nice station locations that really speed up the boarding and lighting of the bus, which all of these things combined cause the system to be much more reliable and obviously to move much faster down the road.
So in a time where the city of Fresno is in severe financial crises, mm-hmm. And has been for some time, and you have pressures from all over facing the city budget, you're embarking on a very ambitious project. Where does this come from, and exactly how is this a prudent idea at this time?
We actually started working on this project several years ago, and we had applied for grants through the federal government, the Federal Transit Administration, and we were awarded a very small STARS grant through the Federal Transit Administration for about $38 million. So 80% of the funding for the project is grant funding coming from the federal government. The other 10%, the match is what we call it, is really coming from state Proposition 1B funds. So all of the money is really coming outside of the community, but we're bringing it into the community, which I hope is going to spur some economic development for Fresno.
I certainly, that's the hope, and it's also the hope I know from your office and from the city planners as well, that this will be something that gets people out of their cars and onto mass transit and will really help reshape the city as we know it right now. A few months ago, the city approved its new general plan, and this was a major headline in the newspaper and on radio here, on this station and elsewhere, that Fresno's now all about building up and building in the existing corridors of Blackstone and Ventura and Shaw Avenue and encouraging people to live there. you aren't going to have more parking lots there. That's really not going to happen. People are going to have to ride something like BRT if that plan is ever going to work.
That's absolutely our goal, and we're absolutely in lockstep with the proposed general plan. I mean, we coordinated very closely with them through this process. So this isn't – even the general plan is not proposing new corridors. These are corridors we've been talking about for many years here in Fresno. And the idea is to have, you know – a rich environment that's full of amenities that are either walkable or bikeable or easily accessible by transit. So you don't really need a car to travel many miles to get to something.
And certainly with that, you need riders. So we'd love to hear from potential riders out there. You can call us and tell us your thoughts. Would something like BRT, again, for lack of a better term, light rail on rubber wheels running down Blackstone, Shaw, and Ventura Avenues, would that get you out of your car? Call us at 800-224-8989 or 559-275-8989. If you're outside of Fresno, would you like to see a system like this where you live? Would you like to see a system like this in Bakersfield or in Visalia? John Downs is our guest from the city of Fresno right now. Let's paint a little more of a picture exactly how this system will work. And this is still a few years off. This isn't going to happen next year.
We're looking at having the project in operation by July 2015. So it's a little ways off, but it's pretty close, too.
So exactly what is this project going to look like? It's going to be this the fax bus with station on the side?
They're going to be articulated, 60-foot articulated buses, which, you know, if you've been watching the Olympics lately, they call them bendy buses. They're the ones that have the accordion and they flex in the middle, 60 feet long. The stations are going to be level boarding platforms, so you don't climb onto the bus. You just walk straight onto it. It's a very easy system. There'll be substantial stations there and signs telling you when the next bus is going to arrive and comfortable waiting areas. So it's going to be a substantial improvement over the existing system. And the buses are going to be uniquely identified. They're not going to look like anything else in the VAC system. So this is going to be a branded, very unique, very high-profile system.
Is it going to be more expensive for the rider?
The fares are proposed at this point to be exactly the same, so we're not changing anything. This is going to blend in with the other service, so people could use both of these at the same point. One of the differences is you will actually purchase your boarding pass before you get on the bus in the terms of the BRT system. So it's like a light rail line. You buy your pass, you get on the bus, you take your ride, and you board from three different doors with on the bus, so it's much faster getting on and off the bus. Should significantly improve the speed.
Why did you choose the corridors that you did? Ventura, going from downtown to the Sunnyside area, Blackstone from downtown to River Park, Shaw Avenue. I'm not exactly sure where the
Shaw Avenue is proposed in the future, but what I can say is there were several reasons, lots of good reasons. First of all, the Blackstone, Ventura, Kings Canyon corridors were two of the busiest corridors we have in their system, very high ridership, over 7,000 passengers a day currently. So these are very busy corridors. So that had a lot of influence on the decision. We went out to the community. We had stakeholder meetings, and we got their input. And they basically told us these were the corridors that they focused on, that they thought were the most important. And I think, you know, of considerable importance to this, these were the corridors that were being focused on by the city of Fresno through their general planning process. So these are the corridors that even the previous general plan, the 2020 GP, had focused on in terms of more intensive development. So from a long-term planning perspective, from a community outreach perspective, and certainly from our existing productivity perspective, these corridors turned out to be very strong candidates as we move forward.
The Fresno Area Express Service certainly has seen an uptick in ridership with gas prices going up and the economy and things. There are complaints about the service, as I'm sure most every public transit mm-hmm. system will have less than a 100% customer satisfaction rating. One of the concerns that I hear from people who commute regularly on the bus is, you know, it just takes so long, and I don't know when the bus is going to be there, and it's really hard to plan your day and your schedule around the service that we have right now. How is this different?
One of the things that's very different, first of all, in a BRT system, buses are running every 10 minutes. So you're really not waiting very long for your bus to come and pick you up. So that's automatically a significant improvement in the comfort level, I'll say, of the wait. The other thing is every station will have an electronic sign telling you when the next bus is coming. It'll say 5 minutes, 4 minutes, 3 minutes, counting down the same way you might see at a light rail station or, for instance, if you were at an airport, watching the signs take away when the buses or when the planes are coming in. So those things are present there. Because of the other activities that were infrastructure we're building into the corridor, the bus will be much more reliable. It's not going to be quite as subject to the problems of traffic congestion because of queue jump lanes and transit signal priority, and some of the other treatments that we're putting into this will make the bus more reliable as well.
Again, we'd like to hear from you and your thoughts. Is the idea of bus rapid transit, is the Valley ready for mass transit and this scale? 800-224-8989 or 559-275-8989. And would you leave your car at home to ride something like BRT? Has this system been tried successfully in other communities like Fresno? I know it's had success across the globe. Fresno is a very auto-dependent environment, and California is, well, at least this part of California is rather warm in the summer and rather cold in the winter. These aren't indoor stations, as I gather. These are outdoor stations. Has this proven successful in any city similar to Fresno?
It really has. Actually, they're all over California. They're in Stockton and Sacramento and Santa Barbara. I mean, there are lots of other systems in cities that are our size. In fact, we've actually taken a little bit of heat because we're one of the last large cities in California to be going forward with the BRT system. So not only is it a demonstrated technology that's been demonstrated in cities our size and smaller and large, but throughout the world. It's not only just in the United States. This is a worldwide practice.
Let's go to the phones now and talk to Howard. You're on Valley Edition.
Sounds exciting, but I'm wondering, what are the endpoints on Blackstone and Shaw, east-west, Kings Canyon? Does it go to California? And will there be parking lots? Intended to be somewhat of a park and ride?
It's a very good question, Howard. John, is there a park and ride component to this, and where
there, there are no
terminus?
Park and rides at this moment. There wasn't funding to put this together. The terminus points, however, are Audubon and Neese in North Fresno off of Blackstone, and all the way out to Clovis Avenue on Ventura Kings Canyon is the current endpoint. Now, we have proposed this service to extend out with growth in Fresno, for instance, the Southeast Growth Area, when it begins to develop. So we could extend the lines. That's part of that. There is a potential for park and ride. It's being discussed, you know, with some of the folks at the Downtown Development and Resource Management Group. So we're looking at some of those things. But as we propose the project, I don't have funding for park and ride, but it's a great idea, and we're certainly exploring opportunities for that.
Howard, would you see would you see bus rapid transit as something that you would ride on a regular basis? Or
I'm retired now, so probably not. But when I work downtown, it would be useful. But if I have to walk 3 miles to get to Blackstone, it doesn't do me any good if I can't park someplace.
That's a very good point, John.
I mean, there aren't. You know, there's, maybe 1,000 people that live in a hub, maybe. It's probably closer to 500 people. So if you don't have a place where I can drive a short distance, park my car, and then use the long routing, I'm not real optimistic, to be honest.
Well, that's a very good point, Howard, and I've heard that mentioned before. You know, the city of Fresno since the late 80s has been talking about making Blackstone Avenue this grand boulevard of mid-rise, high-rise buildings all the way from downtown to North Fresno. It hasn't happened. There's not a lot of people who live on Blackstone. It's not necessarily right now a major employment center for major corporations that have company offices there. How are people going to get from their neighborhoods, maybe in Old Fig or in the Hoover High area? It's quite a walk from...
It can be, and you can take advantage of the existing FACS bus system. So certainly all of our services that intersect with Blackstone would be available to take people, you know, to that corridor and get them on that line. And that's part of the reason, you know, when you look at establishing a system like this, you're looking at building the spine, which really serves a greater purpose in terms of making connections with the larger FACS system. So the two systems are really designed to work together. Although the larger FACS system is not going to be running on 10-minute headways, you would be able to use that service to get to the corridor.
Howard, thank you very much for your call again. We'd like to hear your thoughts on bus rapid transit. 800-224-8989 or 559-275-8989. John Downs is our guest. You just got around $2.4 million from the federal government a couple of weeks ago for another part of this project. Is that in addition to the 30-something million?
Yes.
So tell us about the downtown project and what that means.
That's all about putting, as proposed, to put a mid-block crosswalk at Mariposa and Van Ness that would connect the downtown BRT station with the transfer stations across the street at Courthouse Park to enhance that station area as well as the pedestrian underpass in that area. This forms a very unique connection to the high-speed rail station proposed coming in at Mariposa. And so this becomes a very strong intermodal hub for us. And so we're very excited about having these additional funds to really make that a very nice, you know, rich environment to travel to.
The name of this system, Bus Rapid Transit, the rapid part is I guess, self-evident. How rapid are we talking about? You said every 10 minutes, but compared to a fax bus, if you're going from River Park to downtown right now, what would this new system, how much travel time would it shave off the?
We're looking at probably 20%. And it doesn't sound like a lot, but that's a significant piece of a ride. We should be able to travel from North Fresno to downtown Fresno in under 30 minutes, which would be much faster than the current bus system. And it should be much more comfortable and convenient for you. You're not waiting, obviously, for a bus.
There's always trade-offs to things. With this new system, fax service on Ventura Blackstone would go away, as I understand
we
it?
We would not operate the local service, which is the service that's operating now. And some of the other things that you know people should understand, too, we're increasing the space between bus stops. So instead of having a bus stop every couple of blocks, bus stops are only every half a mile or so. So that means there's a little bit of inconvenience there in walking a little bit further. The trade-off is you get a much faster, more comfortable ride to get to your destination. So these things are all, you know, about trying to understand how the community feels about these things and what they want, which is, I guess, a good opportunity to say, we'd like to have your opinions. You can go to the website, faxbrt.com, faxbrt.com, and please participate in this and take the survey on that at that location. That'll help us to identify those features and those things that are most important to you as we move forward with the project.
You have the endpoints set. Are the stations in between determined at this point, or is that something people can weigh in on at
these? The stations are pretty well set. Those are parameters required in the grant, but it's not that hard to understand that because the stations are pretty much set where we have other transfer locations with other routes. So we try to make it very convenient for fax users. They're major intersections. They're the half-mile grid, so they're the major intersections where we already would be. What people can have some input on is what those stations might look like, how they're designed, what the features of the bus and the bus stop amenities might look like. For instance, we're trying to come up with a good name right now. It's not going to be called Fax BRT, obviously. We don't know what it's going to be called. Part of this process is what we call branding. What are we going to call the service? What's the service going to look and feel like to our community, and how is it going to represent our community when it's implemented? Obviously, we want this to be unique for Fresno.
You had a big outreach event Saturday afternoon at City Hall. Are there others planned? Was that the last one? Where are we in the process of community outreach?
We're just getting started. There's going to be a lot of outreach. We've got several community meetings going forward. We've got these surveys going on. I mean, I think until we have gotten a lot farther along in our planning process, you're going to see continual outreach going on. And probably even after that point, as we go towards implementation, we will be continuing to have outreach to inform and educate people about the project.
Have you gotten as far as ridership projections at this point? Is that hard to say at this?
It's hard to say. I can give you some anecdotal information. We already have very strong ridership on this corridor. As I said, 7,000 passengers a day. We've studied a lot of BRT systems. It's not unusual to see ridership increases of 50% in BRT systems. So, you know, we are anticipating higher ridership. I think that's going to happen. But I really don't have a solid number. I don't have a model that tells me what that is at this point.
If people want more information, how can they participate in this public process?
Well, first of all, you can take that survey at faxbrt.com. You can certainly call Fresno Eric. You can call me. I mean, I'm happy to answer questions about this. My number is 559-621-1502. And we have a multitude of resources. We're happy if you've got a group that wants to have a presentation. We're setting up those meetings. We're happy to meet with you and your group and talk about this at whatever extent you're interested.
It's very interesting as we see rapid transit come to Fresno with bus rapid transit. John Downs has been our guest from the City of Fresno's Transportation Division talking about the new high-speed light rail type bus that is coming to Fresno's Ventura Street and Blackstone Avenue. John, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. Stay tuned. In just a moment, we'll find out what's in store at the Greek Fest, which is coming up later this month in Fresno. I'm sure it'll be a tasty event. We'll find out more in just a moment here on Valley Edition.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition.
This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. My name is Joe Moore, filling in for Juanita Stevenson today. Juanita will be back next week at this same time. Right now, we are about to close our show with our annual Around Town segment. Actually, not our annual Around Town segment, our weekly Around Town segment. And on the calendar coming up later this month is Fresno's 52nd annual Greek Fest, California's premier Greek festival, as it's called, taking place Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, August 24th, 25th, and 26th. Joining us now is Peter Angelo Vallis. Peter Angelo, welcome to Valley Public Radio.
Thank you very much, Joe. Good morning.
Good morning, and Greek Fest is always a fun event for people in Central California who maybe are of Greek ancestry or maybe don't have any idea about Greek culture at all because it's a very welcoming event. What do you have in store this year?
Well, this year we have a lot of the same, which is, you know, it may sound boring coming off my mouth, but it's really something that we enjoy putting on. And people come back year after year for really getting their annual dose of really the same thing. Lots of fabulous homemade Greek food, given that there isn't really a restaurant that makes Greek food in the Valley. This is the only time people within 75, 80 miles of Fresno can have it. We've got all sorts of expanded youth activities to keep kids occupied while parents continue to eat more, water slides, video games, things like that. We bring in vendors from all over the state and even outside of the state selling Greek wares from Greece or other areas in the Middle East. Naturally, we have lots of live Greek music, live dancing demonstrations, live dancing instructions, because just because one didn't grow up dancing these things doesn't mean you can't have a really good time. They're easy to learn, and you can end up dancing for hours and hours and hours. We also do Byzantine chant performances by our choir in the church, along with iconographic tours of our rather historic church, which is known throughout the country for our beautiful ceiling.
I'm not sure if people in the Central Valley really think of this area as having a significant, in size, Greek population. Is that the case? What is
we're
the Greek
community like?
We're
few in number, but we're around. You know, generally speaking, there is a community in Bakersfield, much smaller. There's a community in Modesto that's much smaller. Fresno's community is rather medium size, so to speak, for a Greek community. There are, you know, thousands upon thousands of Greeks in Los Angeles and the Bay Area and definitely across the country. But Fresno's community boasts about 400 or 500 families. And we do this as a great way to let people know that, yes, we're here, and yes, we are a vibrant part of our Central Valley community and have been since the 1920s.
This event has been going on for over half a century now. How has it grown over the years?
It's grown from being, when they started it, long before I was ever around, as a great way just to get friends and neighbors and local businesses to come out and get some Greek food. And, you know, they were really excited because they had 300 people show up the first year. We're estimating that this year we're going to have somewhere, depending if the weather's really nice or not, between 22 and 37,000 people. So it's grown tremendously over the years. And what's neat about the event is that it really does cater to people who are not of Greek ancestry but enjoy being Greek for a weekend. And many people, many of our volunteers, many of the people, they come back day after day to the festival because they have such a good time. And people have a good time at every age group. It's great for kids. It's great for teenagers. It's great for young adults. We have a really nice nightlife scene when things get a little darker. And it's great for the whole family and seniors included.
This event is starting to attract attention from even outside of this immediate area, is it not?
We are. As a matter of fact, we did manage to get some press in New York last year, which was great for Fresno. But we have a reputation within the various community of Greek festivals for putting on a particularly fun event. And we get more Greeks coming from outside the area because they've heard Fresno puts on a really good Greek festival. And it's kind of a nice thing because, generally speaking, 95% of every Greek in Fresno works the event. And we don't have the population of people that are really out there trying to get the crowd dancing and doing things like that. But what's fortunate is a lot of our Armenian friends whose dancing is very similar, they do come out in droves, and they help us by adding that flavor and fun of authentic ethnic experience.
So for people who haven't been to Greek Fest before, tell us the particulars. Is that St. George Greek Orthodox Church? Where is that located, and what are the details when the festival runs, those things?
It is right behind the Fresno Art Museum at 1st and Clinton, and we have parking all over the neighborhood. It's at 2217 North Orchard, but that's not important. Just go to 1st and Clinton, and you'll definitely find it. The festival runs Friday the 24th from 4 p.m. to midnight, Saturday the 25th from 11 a.m. to midnight, and Sunday the 25th from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. Admission's $5 for adults. Seniors and children are free. And during daytime hours on Saturday and Sunday, if you bring a canned good for the food pantry, you get in free with that, too. A couple different things that we are doing this year. For the first time in 20 years, we're giving away a trip. We've got a trip for four, all expenses paid, to Tahiti, to a private island for 5 days, or six days, 5 nights. And we're also doing some pre-selling of some of our favorite foods so that people don't have to wait in quite so many lines. And we're also pre-selling tickets online. And all the information, all the attractions, can be found by visiting FresnoGreekFest.com.
Well, it's very exciting, and certainly our audience looks forward to the event. It's always a great afternoon or evening of fun and food and dancing at the 52nd Annual Fresno Greek Fest, August 24th, 25th, and 26th at St. George Greek Orthodox Church. Peter Angelo Vallis, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Joe. Opa.
Opa. Yes, indeed. Well, that's all for today's Valley Edition. Again, Juanita Stevenson will be back next week. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us at talk@kvpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation.